Hello, darlings. This is Dame Joan Collins with a very special announcement before today's installment. I wanted to personally invite you to a live recording of Dynasty As They Wanna Be. It's all happening this Sunday, September 29th at 4 p.m. at the Anaheim Convention Center at NostalgiaCon, the first ever convention celebrating 1980s popular culture. Tickets are available now at NostalgiaCon80s.com. I suggest you dress to impress. There will be celebrities, autograph signings, concerts, and, of course, the boys will be dishing all the dirt on Dynasty on stage. I'll see you there. I can't imagine you have anything better to do. And welcome to Dynasty As They Wanna Be, a podcast where we drill into every episode of the iconic 1980s television series Dynasty. I'm your host, Derek J. Lang, and with me virtually is Kyler K. Jafari.
Hello.
So in a Dynasty As They Wanna Be first, I am in California and you are in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Excuse me, I'm live via satellite.
Appropriately, you just happen to be in Vegas when we are recording the episode titled Viva Las Vegas. Did you plan that?
No, unfortunately, I'm here way too many times than I should be.
Yeah, you're there for work. I couldn't join you. But the podcast must go on.
And it has. So here we are.
And you go to Vegas a lot. What are your thoughts on Sin City?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at Vegas through the lens of Dynasty circa 1981/82 and compare it to today. You know, like Vegas is a city that's constantly reinventing itself. Although it's kind of like an incidental setting in this episode. So, you know, there's not too much digging in the weeds we must do. However, it's interesting. I've been coming out here for 15 years, and it's gone from, like, that weird thing where they were trying to be family-friendly, and then they decided they would just, no, cater to adults who want to have restaurant experiences and actually spend money on hotels and...
Me.
And not gamble too much. And yeah, and now Vegas is sort of in this like third renaissance in the last 20 years or something. And by the way, the Bellagio is the reason why Olive Garden and your mother decided that Tuscany fantasy needs to be the design decor of everybody's living room for the last 20 years. So that's another thing about Vegas that's you know, revealed itself to me as I've come out here over the years. But anyway, got nothing to do with Dynasty. So yeah, I've got my hangouts here. I love Carson Kitchen. That's still like my jam. And like they don't change the menu at all, which is both a good thing and a bad thing. But they have a nice bar program. And then there's Haleo, which I've been here since the beginning for that place. You know, if you like your Spanish tapas, it's a little expensive, but they have sherry at the bar. And who drinks sherry except for your grandmother at Christmas? You know, but there's also Momofuku, and, you know, they opened an Italy out here. You know, so again, like, it's constantly evolving. Vegas is a strange little canvas for the American dream, I must say.
Yeah, I actually really like Vegas for like 48 hours where you can just sort of like pop in, eat at all the restaurants, maybe have like a little spa moment, lounge by the pool. I don't get any pleasure out of wasting my money on gambling. Those slot machines.
Well, and I think a lot of people don't. I think that's why gambling revenue is like consistently a couple percent down every year out here. You know, like Vegas is not a place people go to gamble the way that they used to. I mean, there's still your diehard gamblers. Like that's never going to change. But now it's more about charging twice as much for hotel rooms. There's no more free hotel rooms. And the food three times more expensive, even if it's not that much better. And, you know, but there is a food scene, so I'll give it that. And, you know, the cocktails are now $17. It's like more expensive to drink out here than it is in LA.
I do remember once, though, even though I don't really gamble, when they introduced like video game, like skill based machines, I did get kind of obsessed with this one machine. And I won money, like not a lot of money, but I kept winning. And then You remember you couldn't pull me away.
Well, I wasn't going to, and you were making like $60 an hour on that, you know, cash cow.
Yeah, and they bring you, they still bring you free drinks too, and it's basically just like playing Candy Crush or whatever. But yeah, that was my only experience with gambling in
Vegas.
Well,
that's been shut down. I walked by those the other day, and they're just, you know, Buffalo Bill slot machines now.
Yeah, I think they thought that was going to revolutionize gambling, and all the millennials were going to come in droves, and then no, they just want to go to the day club, nightclub, slut club, whatever EDM thing is happening.
Well, that's another interesting thing about Vegas is it sort of is the harbinger of nightlife in, you know, American society. And like, you know, in the old days, you could stay out till 4 a.m., hang out with gangsters, lose all your money, and just be drunk for 72 hours or however long your long weekend is. But that's not really what Vegas is anymore. You know, like they still have plenty of nightlife, of course. But yeah, there's like the day clubs and people are really just here to eat, you know. So there's like, it's not as decadent as it used to be.
Well, you know what was decadent this episode was Joan Collins's outfits and Fallon Carrington Colby's antics. There were a lot of people showing their ass on this episode. I could not believe the daringness. Nicholas Toscani, too. He was acting like a little slut.
I want to see them asses.
Well, should we take a break and get into this week's episode, Viva Las Vegas?
Bet it all on black, baby.
Welcome back. Now, as you kind of were saying, I don't know why this episode was called Viva Las Vegas. There's like one scene in a hotel and a couple of establishing shots.
If anything, it's like get the hell out of Las Vegas. It's like not even 24 hours, which actually is the best way to do Vegas.
Well, but also they could have been anywhere. They could have been LA. They could have been Seattle. They could have been Valdosta, Georgia. Like it didn't matter.
No, here's why it was Vegas, because the implication is that it's mob money, and that's how low that Blake has gone, you know, to save his corporation, that he has to go, like, you know, beg and grovel to the mob to buy out, you know, interest in his football team so he can hand over the big bucks to Cecil Colby. So that's why Vegas.
Yeah, no, I know. We didn't really talk about it too much last week because I didn't think it was that big of a deal. But yeah, Cecil Colby is coming for Blake Carrington's football team, which I did say a few episodes ago that I wanted more drama concerning the football team. And now I'm getting it. But this isn't really what I wanted. Blake going to some mobster family we've never heard of in Vegas to beg for $9 million so he could pay off Cecil Colby and rid his hands of him. Like, I don't know, this is boring. Like, leave it to Dynasty to make mobsters in Vegas totally snoozy.
Well, mercifully, we only get about, you know, 4 or 8 minutes of this, you know, interspersed with, like, I don't know, Fallon, like, interjecting her opinions about hot quarterbacks, and that's why the team's worth more than what they're paying for it or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm more interested in the strange hotel decor, which actually isn't really worth talking about, but that's how bad this business storyline is.
Yeah, that hotel, if I checked in, I would immediately cancel my reservation and go down to the Sahara or the Aladdin or fuck, even the Circus. Like, that place was psychotic.
Oh, Circus was a nice joint back in the day. I mean, it was never premium, but... But oddly, this, I think, was like sort of across the street from it. What was this, the Desert Inn or something, which is now...
Well, that's the exterior shot.
Right.
Inside,
well, that's all we have to go on.
I don't know what they're trying to get across.
And that's what's now the Wynn Hotel and the Encore.
No, I mean, that place was psychotic. You have some weird, like, Mary Magdalene statue on one side next to, like, a chrome etagere. There's, like, a hexagonal mirror, a red couch, and then, like... mauve wallpaper. Like, it didn't make any sense.
Well,
it's like they
this
just had a bunch of leftover furniture
the things,
that they all put together
that were really bad about early 1980s decor. It's they couldn't decide if they wanted to be 70s. They couldn't decide if they wanted to just like shore themselves of all of those trappings and just be fully contemporary. So yeah, she'd get chrome etagères and Buddha statues, and you know, there's a lot of gray, beige, and black and tan. It's, you know, but it's also a hotel room, so like it's clearly it's not meant to be lived in. And thank God they don't, because they quickly get on a plane and get the hell out of there.
Well, I will say it was a nice touch that they did have slot machines in the airport set, because that really sells the fact that you're in Vegas, baby.
Yeah, it do. And it's like this like vision of what airports were at that time, which like not that sexy, but compared to today, like super sexy. It's like the champagne lounge at your truck stop hooker joint, you know?
Yeah, and what did you think about Fallon kind of stowing away and ditching Jeff? I thought it was super fucking creepy that she was walking by her father and stepmother's bedroom and was like listening in. Like, what if Blake and Crystal were like getting it on? Like, what a nasty freak Fallon still continues to be.
Well, that, you know, at least she's not doing like super daddy things in this episode. I think she's exercising her own agency, and that's very much expressed through like the jet plane, you know, technically is like more like Blake's agency, but I like that she just sort of like finds herself a stowaway aboard. You know, she weasels her way into this business meeting, even though it's with the mob, and like it's not, I don't know, it's kind of like Bush League. But I think at the end of the day, like we have like Fallon back in some ways. Like this is like, she's not super daddy and she's not ridiculous flapper. She's,
well, I don't know, she did have that line about, I wish I could have married a man like you who's exciting, daddy. Jeff is so boring. That made me cringe totally.
Yeah, I guess you're right. That's like, never mind. Forget everything I said. She's still got problems, and I don't know how long she's for this world.
Daddy, with Jeff, there's no excitement. There's no surprises, no sense of danger. Why couldn't I marry someone like you? Challenging and unpredictable.
Honey, you don't know how lucky you are. You've never lived with me as a husband. If you did, you'd change your pretty mind very quickly.
But I didn't understand why Jeff was so mad that she went to Vegas with her dad. Like, I don't really understand any of like Jeff's motivations this episode.
Oh, I get them. I totally understand them. I think they're pretty like obvious. This goes into a longer discussion of agency, because you know Blake and Fallon are on the plane, right? You know, like jetting around, and like to the extent that they're not even really like, they don't care where they're going, because they're there for like 6 hours or a meeting or whatever. And it's back on the plane. So it's more about the journey than, you know, the destination. And then you have like Claudia and Dr. Tortellini on the horsies, right? And then you got, you know, Sammy Joe chasing down Crystal in the Rolls Royce. So it's this whole thing about like jet planes and horses and fancy cars, you know, and everybody's got like some sort of mode of like physical movement that creates action and you know, progress.
Even roller skates.
Yes, even the roller skates. Jeff has like zero agencies.
Who'd you go there to see?
You mean which lover?
Who?
I told you, I went there with my father, to be with my father. And who the hell are you to question me anyway?
Your husband, babe. Obviously the last guy on the list.
He's like a non-entity at this point. Especially in that marriage, but certainly in the story as well.
Well, you can tell that the writers and crew underestimated what a huge hit Dynasty was going to become, because at one point Cecil does tell his little nephew Jeff that he's the last of the Colbys,
We learn that Jeff's dad was murdered, I guess, or killed in some way. Cecil sort of references it vaguely. But I was just thinking, like, wait a minute. He's not the last of the Colbys. There's enough Colbys for there to be a whole spinoff at some point.
I'm just soaking in a long, hot bubble bath of Cecil as Jeff's father and also as Fallon's father. I think that whole idea is so messed up and so ridiculous that, I mean, I feel like we're stretching the boundaries of soap opera writing, even for nighttime.
Oh, no, it's a Jerry Springer episode for sure.
I don't know. Do with that what you will, which I don't want to do anything with. So.
Yeah. So Blake gets his mob money and heads straight to Cecil to throw it in his face. And I guess their bromance is over?
Well, it's questionable. I don't know if they're frenemies or bros. It's so hard to tell. And can you really be a bro at this age anyway? I mean, when you get to this ripe old age of, I don't know, crowning 50, 60, you
90.
You can't tell. Yeah, because everybody looks like a skeleton. I mean, like, how bro-y can you be? So I don't think it's a bromance. I think these are just, like, longtime frenemies.
You want to know how I knew it was serious?
He rejected his offer of more scotch.
Uh-huh. I have never seen Blake turn down a drink.
Well, you know, maybe that's true. It's a litmus test, right? Like, how alcoholic is Blake now? You know, and this one he's like clearly not chasing the 38-year-old, you know, Henry Kissinger gave this bottle to me scotch. So
what did we learn? Blake loves money and scotch, but he loves money a little bit more than scotch,
but not enough to not give that cashier's check to, you know, good old Cecil Colby, so, and slam mm-hmm. his scotch glass down on top of it as a sort of metaphor, I suppose.
Well, I like them as enemies more. I think that's a more interesting dynamic than having them be frenemies or bros or whatever.
Well, I think, interestingly, this is all Alexis is doing. I think Alexis stirred this all up with the parenthood situation with Fallon and Cecil and, you know, trying to drag Stephen out of the Blake clutches. And somehow in mm-hmm. the weird mix of all of this, Blake and Cecil wound up at the St. Denis Club kibitzing over a football team. But that was all really just a stand-in for, you know, Blake's frustrations with his own family and his own shortcomings as a leader. And here he is. He's like, here's your $9 million, Cecil. And by the way, you know, I hope you enjoyed screwing my ex-wife and, you know, turning my son gay. I don't know. It's like there's like something really screwed up and Freudian about the whole thing with their friendship. So it's even more than just a rivalry, you know.
We didn't mention that there's a big storm raging in Denver this episode. It makes the Carrington Mansion look like it's a setting for a Scooby-Doo episode with all of the thunder and lightning. Very, very frightening.
Yeah, it's again very Midsummer Night's Dream. It's like where the darkness and the moonlight and, you know, the tempest kind of makes everybody cuckoo bananas. And you get all of these like crazy scenarios, like Dr. Toscani's swinger pad and his sister showing up and, you know, and she's like basically telling him he's a psycho/psychiatrist and he's got some vendetta for, you know, Blake about killing their brother. And that's where you sort of like, I don't know, it was pretty obvious from the last couple flashbacks. But anyway, so that's the situation. And so now he's like, he's out for blood with Blake, apparently, and his sister's in on it.
Well, no, not blood. He just wants revenge. He doesn't want to hurt him. He wants to make him suffer.
That's why Alicia, she says, like, Nico, you're a psychiatrist. But I almost for a minute thought she was saying, you're a psychotic. And then immediately he just says, I don't want to kill him. Maniacal smile. And he's, I just want to see him alive, suffering, you know, which is obviously a very psychotic thing. So it takes a nut to know a nut, I suppose. But
yeah, I'm less interested in his reasons for revenge and more interested in what exactly his plan is, because it just seems like he's getting involved in all of the Carrington business, but I don't really see what he's doing to exact his nefarious plan on Blake.
As we've said, he's kind of just a cog in the machinery of whatever this plot is. I don't know. And his acting's like kind of egregious, shall we say. Whatever, like, I don't like the character anyway, so it doesn't matter. The other thing about the thunderstorm setting is this is also the veil of illusion that leads us to Sammy Joe and Steven waking up in bed together the next morning.
Yeah, that little tramp just met him in the last episode, and a couple of thunderbolts come along, and she runs t-shirt and panties right into his bed.
Did you see the totally pervy like camera view following Heather's ass with like barely a t-shirt covering it? Like,
oh yes, like, how could you not?
Like, she's clearly here for one thing and one thing only.
Well, I think she's here for two or three things, depending on how you calculate tits and ass.
Okay, so yes, tits, ass, and Stephen Carrington.
Yeah, and that Stephen Carrington, man, he is a heavy sleeper. The weather doesn't wake him up, and then this
nubile white trash doesn't wake him up.
But he did live in New York, so, you know, people who live in New York generally are pretty heavy sleepers, right?
Yeah, you know, the trash truck, the police, the murders.
Heather Locklear.
But what I like about that is that then you have the morning after, right? Like, the thunderstorm goes away and the sunlight comes out.
Yeah, and I mean, they don't like bang or anything because Steven's gay or bisexual and more attracted to older ladies. So it's not that naughty, but his mama, Alexis Carrington, sees that little tramp walk out the door the next morning and she's not having it.
I feel like this is sort of a recall to Sarah Pat from the Hooker House and Breese's or whatever. Like, I feel like Sammy Joe is this alternative to that, and it's a sort of rewrite of how Sarah Pat was called to the stand to make Steven straight, but she was paid for that, you know? And
yeah, but the difference here is that I think Sammy Joe wants to get on Stephen Carrington's D. Like, she wants to drive around in the Porsche. She thinks his hair is pretty. Like, she's clearly salivating over him.
But again, in this situation, it's Stephen really never has a say in this. And it's, again, it's this gay amnesia thing where he's not really participating in his own sexuality.
Crystal knows it too. When she finds out from Alexis, she kind of confronts Sammy Joe after her roller skating down the damn driveway and kind of seems to caution her. She doesn't outright come and say, hey, maybe don't date my gay stepson whose ex-boyfriend new husband murdered.
This is a whole thing about Alexis that, like, yeah, because you brought up a second ago, she like kind of just insinuates herself and shows up. Here she is in the house again. Like, what is she doing there? And she's got like paintbrushes and this like really cute seashell belt with the fuchsia tassels on it or something. And she's like listening in, and then she sees Sammy Joe, and now she's like, but this is what Alexis does. She sees something and she formulates an opinion and she judges and she paints it. And that's like Alexis is like, this is like this great metaphor for Alexis, how she paints. Like, she sees something and she interprets it. She interprets it through her own eyes and she makes that judgment.
She spent the night with Stephen. You know that for a fact. I saw her in Stephen's room this morning and they weren't playing Parcheesi.
You saw them. And so you jumped to the conclusion that they were sleeping together. Now that is bizarre, Alexis. That is twisted.
Is it, Crystal? Is it? I am talking about my son.
And about my niece. What are you saying? That she's too common for him? Is that it?
You know, you sound as though you approve.
Crystal does not judge. Crystal just asks questions and tries to understand. Crystal's understanding is very passive. She's sort of like deductive. And, you know, Alexis is very inductive. And sometimes Alexis gets herself in trouble for that. Like, sometimes her judgment is off. And that's what you find out here. Like, Sammy Joe and Steven are really doing anything at all. It's, I mean, if anything, Sammy Joe's just trash trying to, like, you know, sneak in on a good time. But for all that, Crystal's like, yeah, but that's not really what's going on. Those two aren't sleeping together.
Alexis really took a turn for me in this episode. You know, I've been standing for her. I've been so excited for her arrival. But I'm sorry, she was just downright evil.
Well, like, in what way? I mean, obviously she's evil, but, like, there's so many ways to be evil, and Alexis shows all the colors of that rainbow.
Well, it's one thing to try to blow up her son's relationship with the tramp in the mansion, but it's another thing to point a gun towards a pregnant woman who's on a horseback. Like, what did she think was going to happen? Like, what was going through her head? I mean, there's no forgiving somebody for that, you know? Like, she clearly was trying to hurt the unborn baby, which is just crazy to me. And frankly, I feel like Alexis is smarter than that. Like, there's got to be other ways to get at Crystal and to get at Blake. Like, I don't know, just it seemed too nasty for me.
I think that more came from, like, Alexis's, like, desire to control her son. And here,
well,
she is.
Well, there was,
like,
clearly, like, no immediate remorse for doing that. Like, maybe, okay, oh, I went too far. And then, but then she goes into the house to visit Crystal, bringing a, you know, Tiffany baby rattler or whatever. And the doctor's there. Crystal's clearly losing the baby.
No, but, like, Alexis, yeah, she shows up again, and she's changed outfits for the third time this show. You know, she's just, like, got the baby prezi, and they're like, no, no. You know, Crystal's, you know, with potential miscarriage upstairs. You better go away. And Alexis is like, but just for a minute, just to make sure she's all right. You know, like, which to me is like saying just to make sure that she's not all right. And then she sort of puts the cherry on top and says, I really do care. And it's like, no, she really does care if her plan's working out. That's really, so this is all just like Alexis, like, you know, executing her wiles and gauging the results. I think to your point, though, it does go a little bit further than she expected. And now she feels like she's in a little bit of trouble, but she's ultimately kind of cool that Crystal's pregnancy might be in jeopardy as a result of her actions.
Well, I don't want to get into, like, a whole pro-life, pro-choice debate here on Dynasty as they want to be.
Yeah.
But, like, Alexis, what the fuck? The baby didn't do anything. The baby's just, like, innocent, you know? Like, if you have it out for Crystal or Blake, have it out with them. But I don't know. I've been approving all of Alexis's nasty machinations, but this is one that I cannot support.
Well,
Sorry, doll.
I think when you couple this with the, you know, the marital sexual violence in the prior season, you know, that's sort of indicative of, like, I'm not excusing it as the time period, but it is the time period. Like, that these things are, we were more in touch with our physical human being, and I think these things were just more acceptable, at least for dramatic purposes, and it results in a very unfavorable comparison today, obviously. But,
well, speaking of going too far, Dr. Nicholas Toscani was dressed as Woody from Toy Story this entire episode. That's Fallon's kink, because as soon as her and Jeff get into a little quibble, she gets all wet for Dr. Toscani, speaking French in the hallway, basically throwing herself at him.
Like, they're literally Frenching. They're, like, exchanging French, you know, phraseology. I would not say French dialogue. It's kind of clumsy, but so that's sort of, I guess, the foreplay to what happens at the end of the episode, where she's talking about this dream boy coming out of the Mediterranean Sea.
I was turned on.
Wet body and wet hair and wet hands. And then she says, making me wet. And I don't know. I mean, that's pretty clear what that suggests.
What is it, Nick? I thought you'd be quick to take advantage of an unexpected pleasure.
It's the altitude up here.
Well, maybe you shouldn't keep on standing up there.
I could not believe how hot and sexy Fallon and Dr. Nicholas Toscani were, and that this was broadcast on ABC.
I mean, yeah, it's like, take your pick. Is it the gunshot, you know, horsey miscarriage? Is it the Fallon vaginal moisturizing talk? Yeah, like, there's so much that is so nighttime about all of these things. Like, it might be too nighttime for today. I don't know that we can say these things in today's world.
Well, I definitely did not see this coming.
Well, she did, and she basically said as much. And it's like, how many more of these, like, very sexual double entendres are we going to get in the dialogue? But that's the only, that's it. You know, it ends there.
Well, I'd much rather watch her talk and fuck Dr. Linguini versus tell her daddy how much she loves him and how much she's daddy's little girl. Like, this is the kind of relationship Fallon should be pursuing.
Yeah, but I think he's another one of these, like, servant of the household, like Michael. Like, she gets her sexual kicks from one, and, you know, her daddy kicks from Blake, and she can never really find the right guy to, like, fill that void, as it were. Obviously, Jeff is not. Jeff cannot be daddy, and Jeff is no sex god, so that's why she's got nothing to do with him.
Well, I think that Dr. Fettuccini is definitely an upgrade from Michael, the worst chauffeur in the history of chauffeurs, so...
Yeah, and he drives a DeLorean instead of some, you know, six-year-old Lincoln limo.
Yeah, man, and they're really putting that DeLorean on the screen. Like, anytime they get a chance, like, it's parked next to the horses, it's outside of his bachelor sex pad, it's in front of the Carrington mansion, like... They really should have put the DeLorean in the opening credits.
Well, what they did put in the opening credits was this interesting change for Alexis's title card. And
oh, yeah.
What is that rooftop? I mean, it doesn't look any more sexy than any other city rooftop, but there is a pool and people, including men and women, in bikini swimsuits.
I think it's probably like where her penthouse is located in Acapulco.
Possibly. It didn't look very Acapulco to me, but nothing on this show looks like anything except for Los Angeles.
Definitely. Well, I think that about wraps it up for Viva Las Vegas. Are you ready to get into your lurk of the week?
I think I am.
Ka-ching. Well, I think for this week's Lurk of the Week, it's probably a tie. I think we probably decided on the same thing, because I remember when it came on screen, we were both all aghast at Alexis's plaid red ensemble for skeet shooting. Oh my god, how is there so much skeet shooting on this show? The Carringtons must go through at least like 50k in skeets. They're always out there just shooting up at
what
the sky.
What is a skeet anyway? I mean, don't tell me, because you don't know and I don't either. I don't know. There was like this like it's between the horse riding, the skeet shooting, the Rolls Roycing. It's just so like 80s luxuriousness. But all that aside, yeah, the thing is Joan is, you know, hunting for grouse on the moor in this outfit. It is like pure kilt and beret action. And it's like, frankly, such a ridiculous outfit. Again, this character, she is so costume, but not in a TV way. Like, that's literally like in real life, that's what she is. Like, she's wearing costume to go skeet shooting. I mean, technically this is what you would call country attire, but that's all derived from tradition, which is very lost to those of us in today's world. But again, this is Denver, Colorado, so does she really need to wear grouse hunting attire from Scotland to skeet shoot in Colorado? Probably not.
Well, what are you supposed to wear grouse hunting?
I mean, well, you know, for a very good example, you've got the contrast of Crystal in the jodhpurs and equestrian boots and, you know, tan brown pinstripe blouse, which is sort of bleh and not nearly as exciting. So this is why Alexis always wins, because she's like, I'm going to put on the FU red and plaid Scottish tartan.
Well, I get what the costume designers are doing now. Like, they are really selling the fact that Alexis is worldly, because we've seen her wearing, you know, an English countryside outfit. We've seen her wearing French art teacher outfit. We've seen her dressed as a waitress from a Mexican restaurant. Like, this is a woman who took her Carrington hush money and traveled the world and picked up some ensembles while she was at it. So I get it and I love it. She's standing out. She's the star of the show. I mean, literally when she's skeet shooting with Steven, like, the trees are green, the grass is green, Steven's green, everything's green. And then here she is, this flame flickering in the forest. I just love it.
Yeah, but then at the same time, it's with the Scottish tartan pattern in green, you know, so it all kind of fits and yet totally contrasts.
Brigadoon.
Also, the vision of her with a double barrel shotgun, that's actually part of the look, I think. Like, the white powder makeup, the dainty earlobe earrings, and the outfit and the double barrel shotgun, it's all kind of one and the same.
The only thing really unfortunate about that outfit is that's what she was wearing when she decided to make Crystal miscarry her baby.
Well, this is, you know, the savagery of the Scottish countryside. You know, this is, we pick out your wife and we pick off, you know, your baby. It's very, very savage.
Alexis Braveheart. Well, Kyler, thank you so much for taking time out of the craps table and away from the buffet to sit down in your hotel room and discuss Dynasty with me. Are you going to go down to the casino floor and bet everything on red, just like Alexis? All right. Well, thank you again. And thank you, listeners, for listening. If you'd like to follow along with us on social media, we're at Nasty Podcast. That's NASTY Podcast. We're gaining some new followers on Instagram, so join along. I try to post fun pics, little videos here and there to keep the Dynasty love going throughout the week. And if you want to keep the love going, give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you can review podcasts. Let your friends and others know about what's going on here at Dynasty as they want to be. Until next week,
pull.